Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Start with the Valley Freeway's 51 southbound. A crash at Bethany Home Road has the right lane blocked. Also watch out for a crash 202 eastbound the Red Mountain Freeway at Gilbert Road. It'll be sunny for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high of 95, a few degrees warmer than average. Clear tonight, overnight lows in the mid to upper 60s. Sunny and 93 for a high tomorrow. Right now, under sunny skies, it's 93 degrees at KJZZ. A local economist is blaming slower population growth for Arizona's sluggish recovery compared to past recessions. Elliot Pollock says the state's population is projected to grow around 2% annually for the next several years. He compares that to the historic growth rate of 3.5%.
They'd come here, they'd bring their families, they create a demand for goods and services that creates more jobs, which brings in more people, and it would spiral upward.
Speaking during the Greater Phoenix Chamber's Economic Outlook 2017, Pollock also said millennials are marrying on average 5 years later than baby boomers, and many are postponing buying homes and having kids. He expects Arizona's economy to continue to grow, but at a slower rate than past recoveries. Federal prosecutors said in a court meeting today that they will pursue criminal contempt of court charges against Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block is here with me to explain the latest. So, Jude, we're going to get into what happened in court, but first, just remind us what today's court meeting was about and how we got there.
Right. So back in August, the judge overseeing the racial profiling lawsuit against the sheriff asked federal prosecutors to pursue criminal contempt of court charges against Arpaio and three others. That's his chief deputy, an MCSO captain, and an attorney. And the judge found they had willfully violated his court orders. The biggest violation the judge had found was that Arpaio ignored a 2011 order that said he had to stop making immigration-related arrests. But there were also the issues facing the other three defendants had to do with failing to turn over evidence after the judge ordered it, specifically hard drives from a secret informant, Dennis Montgomery, and over 1,500 identifications the sheriff's office had confiscated that were supposed to be handed over to the court and its monitor. And so after the judge made the recommendation for criminal contempt charges, the U.S. attorney for Arizona recused himself, citing a conflict of interest, and lawyers in D.C. with the public integrity section took over. But up until today, we didn't know whether they would pursue charges or not. This was the very first meeting of all those parties in front of a new judge. This is Judge Susan Bolton's courtroom where this all happened. And today, the prosecutors from D.C. made clear they would be charging Arpaio with criminal contempt of court.
Jude, as you mentioned, there are a few defendants and a few different violations here. What do we know about what exactly the charges will be?
We know the Justice Department wants to prosecute Arpaio specifically for continuing to make immigration-related arrests after the judge said he had to stop. So the other charges, which relate to the other three defendants as well, have to do with withholding evidence, but they're going to proceed separately. And the government itself actually said in court, we're worried that the statute of limitations have already run out on those other possible criminal contempt charges. That's an issue we're going to hear more about because actually the judge, Judge Bolton, wasn't entirely convinced. And so she wants to research it more. So even if the prosecutors decide that those other cases can't be charged with criminal contempt, they did say we're continuing to investigate whether we can charge them with obstruction of justice, a totally different criminal charge. That's still up in the air how it'll shake out. All that is certain today, after today's meeting, is that Arpaio will face a criminal contempt of court charge.
Well, and you've reported before that criminal contempt can be punished with incarceration. What are we looking at in this case?
So an interesting tidbit that came out is that the prosecutors also said they were willing to agree to only ask for 6 months or less of prison time. They cited Arpaio's advanced age. He's 84 years old. The prosecutors also said that would mean, though, that the sheriff would have to give up his right to a jury trial. It would be a bench trial in front of Judge Bolton instead. Arpaio's lawyer, Mel McDonald, absolutely says he wants a jury trial, so they're going to continue to debate that issue. Some of the sheriff's opponents were disappointed to hear the sheriff would not face more prison time. I should mention that outside the courthouse, a lot of young people who opposed the sheriff with the Basta Arpaio campaign to get him out of office, they were chanting, they had big signs, they were rallying, they had the big balloon out there of Arpaio in prison stripes. They're eager to see this case go forward. They were also saying they want to beat him at the ballot box first.
Right, Arpaio running for his seventh term right now, facing Democratic challenger Paul Penzone. Early voting begins tomorrow and early ballots will be in the mail.
Right. And it's clear that any criminal trial going forward won't be until long after this election. The earliest date for a trial will be early December. But Arpaio's defense lawyer, Mel McDonald, said very clearly he's going to be asking for an extension. That December date is a no-go.
So, Jude, then what can we expect to happen next?
Well, we can expect the charging document against Arpaio to be filed by prosecutors for the judge's signature by the end of the day tomorrow. So that formally kicks off this criminal case against Arpaio.
That's KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Jude, thanks as always.
Thank you.
A new plan for managing Glen Canyon Dam and the ecosystems downstream from it is a step closer to reality. The U.S. Interior Department has released its final environmental impact statement for the dam's adaptive management plan. A final decision could come next month, and implementation could start next year. With me to explain are Katrina Grant, chief of the Adaptive Management Group for the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, and Rob Billerbeck, the National Park Service's Colorado River Coordinator. And Rob, let me start with you. By way of background, can you give me a sense of what it is that you've been working on?
We've been working for the last 5 years on reoperating the Glen Canyon Dam in terms of how it does releases that go through Glen and Grand Canyon. And that has been to comply with the Grand Canyon Protection Act using the best available science. And this EIS has been a way to incorporate and adapt to that new science to better protect the resources downstream of the dam.
Katrina, how do you think that this new plan will do that, will better protect resources beyond the dam?
The plan uses the best, takes into account all of the new science that we've been learning over the past 20 years. And so we do several things with this. The new plan has several experiments, continuing existing experiments like high flow releases that build beaches. We have fish management tools for protecting the endangered species, the endangered fish in the canyon. And furthermore, the plan, another important part of it, is collaboration and cooperation with the stakeholders in the canyon. So there's a good communication and coordination piece to how we go about doing these experiments.
Under this new plan, how different would operations be than how they have been over the past number of years?
For river rafters, the operations in the dam will look very similar. The high flows, as Katrina mentioned, will become more frequent, and that will benefit the beaches along the way, both for habitat and vegetation. For water users who may be looking to take water out of Lake Mead, there will be no differences. The same annual amount of water will move between the two lakes, so water delivery will continue as it has. So, and the endangered species should benefit under this new preferred alternative if that is selected in the record of decision.
Without getting too overly technical, what about the science and what in the science has changed over the past couple of decades that has led you to go from what you had been doing to what now you are proposing to do?
Yeah, probably the biggest aspects of that are some of the improvements in the science related to sediment management, so the sand, and how we can time releases out of the dam and frequently run those high flow events, high flow experiments, as well as a lot of new science related to the endangered fish. Some of the newest science on that relates to the food base, what the fish eat.
There's been some concerns raised by some environmental groups, perhaps most notably the group Save the Colorado. And among their concerns, I want to list a couple of them and then ask for your responses to them. One of them is that this draft plan doesn't recover endangered fish. It just kind of restocks them. Another is that the EIS doesn't really address climate change and some potential effects from the dam itself. How would you respond to those?
In terms of the endangered fish, this plan, within the scope of the releases that we can do from the dam on the monthly, daily, and hourly basis, this plan will benefit the humpback chub and the razorback sucker, the two endangered fish downstream. And it does show improvement for those species over the no action. Some aspects of how much it may improve it, as I mentioned, are experimental, such as the food base improvements. So we don't know how much it may improve it, but we can find that out over time as part of the adaptive management.
And then with respect to climate change, this study did evaluate the potential impacts of climate change. We looked at a wide range of inflows, as well as then weighting those inflows to be more similar to what could be expected under a climate change scenario. So Department of Interior, we absolutely consider climate change when looking into the future. We're directed to do so. And so in that, what we found was that despite the range of possible inflows, it didn't change the order of the alternatives, but meaning that whether climate change is occurring or not occurring, moving into the future, or the range or depth of the climate change, we do know that climate change is occurring, we would still choose the same alternative moving forward.
Katrina Grants is chief of the Adaptive Management Group for the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. We also heard from Rob Billerbeck, the National Park Service's Colorado River Coordinator. We were talking about the final environmental impact statement for the new adaptive management plan for Glen Canyon Dam.
It's the show on 91.5. Along with the takeaways, Tons Willick, I'm Mark Brody. Donald Trump's lewd talk on that video continues to impact the presidential race. The first poll that came out after the tapes were released was an NBC Wall Street Journal poll on Monday. It showed Hillary Clinton pulling ahead by 11 percentage points over her opponent, Donald Trump. It's a small poll, and it's only one poll, and it doesn't take into account Sunday's debate, but there's no way it's good for Donald Trump. Civics and government classes in schools all across America are following this election, and teachers find themselves standing in front of students who are consuming an election with candidates unlike any they ever remember seeing before. Sometimes there are students who feel they're the target of anti-immigrant or anti-Muslim rhetoric, and it's also a safe bet that roughly half of all classes are girls who are watching right along with the boys who are consuming the election, too. It's a teaching challenge.
We spoke with two educators before school started this morning. John Dixon is a government teacher at Monomoy Regional High School in Harwich, Massachusetts, on Cape Cod. He's been a teacher for about 25 years now. And Joy Bach, an eighth grade social studies teacher in the Groveport Madison School District in Columbus, Ohio. John Dixon, you have high school students. How have you been teaching this election so far?
Well, we've been teaching this election like we teach every election, in terms of trying to help the students have context to the election and helping them understand both sides of a campaign and people who choose on either side of an election.
Joy Bach, you've got younger students who probably understand an election like this on a different level than the older kids.
They do. They are very much different. It's not always put into perspective to them. Voting seems so far down the road. So to really engage them and put it into perspective is always a challenge.
All right. So that all sounds pretty familiar to me. John Dixon, you said you make an effort to teach both sides to these students. But then right there, I start to kind of raise an eyebrow because so much about this election, and I've covered a lot of them, is different. Really different from any past election. Now, you took your students to a Trump rally earlier this year, and I want to start there because there's so much about the language and the strategy of this election that the country hasn't seen in a long time, a very long time.
Yes, so I took a group of students to the Iowa caucuses and attended 12 rallies while we were there, candidates of both parties, and we did get a chance to attend a Trump rally, and it happened to be the Trump rally where he encouraged the audience to attack any protester and that he would pay their legal costs. So we did have a front row seat at some of the more, I guess, harsh elements of this campaign. But to, in terms of giving context, to understand the campaign, for example, we talk about the 1994 election, the restriction of the federal government that was promised then, and then in some people's minds was betrayed by the Bush administration, and how this resentment helped lay the groundwork for the Tea Party movement and today the Trump campaign.
So there's a great deal of context there, frankly, that I don't see in a lot of media reporting about the phenomena that led to the Trump campaign in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's, I guess, part of the nature of being a social studies teacher in middle or high school is that we, first of all, have the luxury of time in terms of having students all year. And that's certainly part of our job to help them understand what's going on today in relation to what's happened before.
Joy Bock, we can't get around in this election some of the language that's been spoken, not only in tapes that we've seen in the last few days that are completely inappropriate, I would take it, for your students, but also language about immigrants, language about religious groups and Muslims. Can you give me a sense of how your younger students process what they see on the news and what they take to class?
They process a lot of it right at heart. I mean, it touches them deeply. I have a young girl whose family has immigrated from Peru. She broke my heart one day. She's 14 years old, scared to death, because her parents have told her if Trump wins, they're going to need to leave to be safe. And so now that's said in the middle of my classroom with 30 other students sitting around looking like, is she really not going to be safe? And so it has had a greater impact on them, I think, during this election than any other election. They haven't heard this type of harsh tone. The things we in eighth grade are still telling them, be kind to one another, don't, you know, make fun of others. And they're seeing it now done by a level of person that they were told that, you know, you should have the utmost respect for. So it is very different and has made for difficult conversations.
And how do the students themselves react? I mean, they know that there's a dissonance here. They know what the right thing is to do. You've told them, and their parents tell them to treat others with respect and don't make fun of other people or exclude them. They see a presidential campaign that is often the opposite of that. Do they voice and vocalize how confusing that can be?
They do vocalize how confusing it can be. Yesterday was Columbus Day. Many students had off. We of course, did not. We had school. And, you know, first words out of their mouth before I could, you know, was good morning for me. But out of their mouth was, did you see the tapes this weekend? And I'm like, no. Please don't repeat any of the words. But, you know, it was top of their priority. So regardless of the lesson I had planned, that kind of took precedent for the moment to connect to what's going on and to tie it into the Electoral College conversation we were getting ready to have. So it has really impacted their lives. I see them paying much closer attention this election. Eighth graders are kind of sometimes hard to engage into an election. 4 years down the road to vote seems so far off to them, but this has really taken their attention.
John Dixon, you talked a little bit earlier about how you teach the background and the political road to how we got to this point, particularly as it stands now in the Republican Party. That's the big transition going on at the moment in American politics. How do you teach the birther phenomenon to your students, and how do they react to it?
It's a good example. I mean, it's in many ways it's reprehensible, and there's no way to teach it without emphasizing the counterfactual nature of the argument. But one of the things we point out is that the seed is a law in Hawaii that makes birth certificates not public record. So that lack of public record is what allows the beginnings of a conspiracy to come about. But it turns out we've been reading the Constitution in the last week, and one thing we discovered or we pointed out is that even if the president wasn't born in the United States, as long as he was born a citizen, he's eligible to be president. So regardless of where he was born, unless people argue that his mother wasn't his mother, he's eligible to be president.
And do you get into some of the darker motivations or some of the more insidious implications of the birther phenomenon that go back to 2011? I mean, really, for adults, behind all this is an idea that the first black president can't possibly be a real American and can't be one of us.
Absolutely. We do talk about racism. It's a very important part of our class and our discussion to talk about racism, to talk about the bias that was behind many people's motivations in an issue like the birther phenomena. And I think events like Colin Kaepernick's protest and the many athletes and celebrities that have responded to that gives us a great window to talk about race in the modern context.
So, Joy Bach, let's word associate just for a moment if we can, because I'm so interested in how your eighth grade students kind of process the characters in this election. If I were to sort of open it up to impressions, one word answers with your kids and say Hillary Clinton, what would be some of the most likely answers I would get back?
They think she's nicer. She seems organized to them. She seems to have answers to them as compared to, I'll skip to the other side, Trump, where they seem to think he's angry, he's mean, he's, you know, not kind to others, he makes enemies, he's degrading. It's becoming in my classroom a very good, bad situation. But in the eighth grade mindset, that's often how they relate things, good and bad, and, you know, not to the level of high school students yet.
Do they associate dishonesty with Hillary Clinton in the way that so many voters seem to?
You know what, the students don't really see the dishonesty that the adult voters seem to be holding on to. They realize she made a mistake, but they're so tech savvy and they use their phones and things every day of their life. They understand how mistakes can be made with technology, and they don't see it as a big deal and as being dishonest as the adults of the country do.
Now, John Dixon, how long have you been teaching?
This is my 20th year in this district.
Well, that would mean if I'm subtracting 20 that you started teaching right around 1996. I mean, you were teaching back in 1998 then when President Bill Clinton had a major confrontation with Republicans over his own sexual behavior, and it's the Monica Lewinsky scandal.
Yes, that actually was my first year in this district. It was the year of the of that scandal and the later trial, and it was certainly a challenge. And that was my first exercise in speaking in euphemisms in class and having to discuss what was in the news and being sensitive to students' sensibilities as far as what we can and can't discuss in class.
John Dixon, government teacher at Monomoy Regional High School in Harwich, Massachusetts. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Joy Bach, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Joy Bach is an eighth grade social studies teacher at Groveport Madison School in the swing state of Ohio.
And that's Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway. Over the past few decades, there has been a big increase in the number of homes built in what's called the wildland-urban interface, basically where development meets undeveloped land. And that can have a significant impact on fighting wildfires. Eric Segarra has been looking into this. He's senior data reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. And Eric, what exactly did you find?
There's actually a large amount of the population actually does live within the wildland-urban interface. About a third of the new homes built since 2000 have been in these wildland-urban interface areas. And since 1990, we estimate about 8.5 million homes were built there. And part of this is because the wildland-urban interface kind of shifts all the time. As more homes are built, they push out further into the wilderness, and that increases the area that falls inside the wildland-urban interface. But the other thing that also happens is that as more homes are built or infill, that interface actually shrinks in other areas. But overall, what we're seeing is a growth throughout the country.
Yeah, I was curious if this is a reflection of people moving sort of away from cities and even suburbs, or a matter of the wildland-urban interface kind of encroaching into where people are.
I think it's probably more of the former. I think what we're seeing is that more and more people are moving out into the suburbs, the exurbs. They're kind of pushing out from the city centers. And it's not so much that the wildland is encroaching as sprawl is encroaching on wildland.
What are some of the impacts and implications of this increased population in this particular area, this wildland-urban interface?
Well, it's actually kind of funny because it's not only are we putting houses, flammable structures, or fuel for fires inside the wildland-urban interface, but we're actually introducing people into that area. And 95% of wildfires are actually started by humans. So we're increasing the probability of wildfires starting by adding more and more houses in these areas.
Well, given that you can't really tell people in many cases where they can or cannot live, is there anything that city, state, federal, any kind of authorities can do about this?
Right. And so I think what we're seeing right now is that communities, local governments are very hesitant to kind of regulate where people can and can't live because it, you know, comes down to property rights. So they're really turning towards things like telling them how they can build, you know, what sort of building materials they can use, how their yards have to look, that sort of thing, with weed clearing laws and stuff like that. So that's kind of like the way that they're approaching things now. As to whether or not it's effective, I think what you see a lot of times with these fire-wise communities, those communities that have been built to kind of withstand fire, have been pretty successful throughout the country.
For homeowners who live in designated floodplains, they are required to buy flood insurance. Is there anything feasible that authorities or governments could do for folks who live in areas that are particularly prone to wildfires?
You know, that's an interesting point because I was speaking with a researcher the other day and they said, you know, when you go to buy a house, a realtor is required to tell you if there's a flood risk, but there is no requirement in the books that asking realtors to tell you if there's a fire risk. And I've spoken to some people in the insurance industry, and I'm not necessarily sure that they think that fire insurance, for example, would be a good idea. I know that some of the nonprofit advocates that we've spoken with said, hey, it's just another reason for insurance companies to raise rates in those areas.
Did you have any kind of indication that this sort of population shift is putting firefighters more at risk or costing more money in terms of having to fight fires that, you know, if nobody's living there, there are no structures, maybe fire managers just let burn?
You know, actually, fighting fires in the wildland-urban interface is both incredibly expensive and incredibly dangerous. Firefighters, when they start having to worry about protecting structures and lives and stuff like that, they're more prone to put their lives on the line, and it gets dangerous for them. It's also more expensive. The U.S. Department of Agriculture looked at a few fires in the California area, and what they found is in grass and brush, it costs about $61 an acre to extinguish a fire there. In forests, it's about $800 an acre. And in the wildland urban interface, it's about $1,700 an acre, so substantially more expensive.
Eric Segarra is the senior data reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. You can hear Reveal Sunday afternoons at 3 here on KJZZ.
Milton. Hi. Could you turn that down just a little bit?
Well, I was told that I could listen to the radio at a reasonable volume from 9 to 11.
Yeah, no, I know you're allowed to.
Some days you might feel like Peter Gibbons and just want to get out of that office space. Alternative workspaces are on the rise, so if you have the choice, you might go for a comfy chair over a cubicle. The show's Annika Klein shows us where the trend is growing, starting in a coffee shop.
It's loud and busy here, but a lot of people are really intent on getting work done. There might be just as many laptops as coffee cups on the tables.
I'm working on an essay.
Rachel Kirkpatrick is sitting with a couple other college students who are also focused.
I like the environment. I also like just change in scenery.
Her table mate agrees.
I feel like it's interesting to look at architecturally.
Sana Zadi is a student and graphic designer. I asked her, if you're looking at your computer screen for work, why does the space around you matter?
When there's a space that naturally attracts good vibes, you tend to just have a little bit more of a flow. Like, you give yourself breaks more and you enjoy them.
Kirkpatrick jumps in.
Millennials in general like the idea of a new space.
And she's right, at least according to After College. That's a company that connects students with employers. Last year, its annual survey showed 68% of respondents said the option to work remotely would increase their interest in an employer. As these students get back to the grind, Linda Zugek explains why these remote workspaces are so popular. She's a workforce consultant.
Basically, the advent and increase of technologies that enable individuals to work remotely has shifted our past perceptions of what a workspace actually is, and it gives us more choice.
When your main tool is a laptop, you no longer have to be confined to one cubicle in one building.
I do see an increase overall in employers recognizing that this is not just sort of a passing fad. It will be a driver of their competitiveness in the future.
And the options aren't just coffee shops or working from home. Because where there's a need, there's a business idea.
I'm Ty Fishkind. I'm the hospitality manager at Mod Phoenix.
Mod is one of the many boutique workspaces that have popped up in recent years. You pay a fee, and Mod is your office for the day, kind of like Airbnb for work.
So what we're trying to do is make it easy for people to take pleasure out of their workday. So things like natural light, healthy food, meditation, walking meetings.
And of course, coffee. They find what people like about alternative workspaces, like their favorite coffee shop, and combine it with what people like about offices. It's quiet, professional.
A space like this gives you the ability to have those one-on-one meetings, whether it's a group scenario where we're flying people in. We're able to have those meetings, you know, in office space.
That's Robert Van Arlen. He's a business coach and speaker, and he needs his workspace to be as flexible as his schedule.
So one day we may have four of our executive team members here, and then the next day we may have one or two, and we all travel all the time. So just having that flexibility, it's kind of like a condo. You can lock and leave it.
And when you do leave it, there are a bunch of websites to help you find more of these types of workspaces for rent. But Linda Zugek says some employers are hesitant to unleash their employees from the central hub.
When people work remotely, you don't really have a firm handle on what might be going on with individuals and how they're communicating with each other or as a group.
That can be hard for startups that begin in flexible workspaces but outgrow them. And of course, there are lots of businesses that are location specific. Those employees can't just take a laptop and head out. So Zugek says the solution is to bring what people like about alternative workspaces into the traditional office building.
Spaces that are a little bit more sort of lounge-like and employees can move freely through that. I mean, that's really ideal.
It goes back to that vibe the students at the coffee shop were talking about. It's hard to put your finger on, but you know it when you feel it. Here's Sanazadi again.
Being here definitely does wonders for me, and it's nice to feel comfortable in the space that you work at.
The students want that flexibility after college, too. The question is whether their future employers will be ready to meet that demand. For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
Amidst all the talk about building walls and relationships between the U.S. and Mexico, a Mexican architect wants to build a brand new city straddling the two countries. Fernando Romero's binational plan would be located between New Mexico, Texas, and the Mexican state of Chihuahua, not far from El Paso and Juarez. Romero wants dense zoning and good public transit and roadways. To get a sense for this proposal and its feasibility, I'm joined by Tanvi Misra. She's a staff writer at CityLab, which is the urbanism website of The Atlantic magazine. She's written about these plans. And Tanvi, design-wise, what exactly would the city look like?
Design-wise, so it's a hexagon, which is really interesting. It has these, like, hexagonal grids, so it's radial, essentially. So it would sort of have these like little nodes, and then there's going to be all these streets sort of going out of those nodes, right? So like kind of rays of the sun. That's kind of what it looks like.
How does he propose getting around the issue of a city being within two countries that have different laws and different currencies and just different ways of doing things?
That's really interesting because he doesn't actually get into what this would mean politically. But I think in terms of how this is going to play out, he plans to build it on private land and actually develop it for real. This is not just a concept. He wants to develop it for real in the next 10 years. How that's actually going to happen, especially in, you know, the current political scenario and how we look at the border between the U.S. and Mexico, I'm not sure. I actually reached out to them for comment, and they haven't really got back to me.
Taking away the issues of dealing with two different countries and different laws and currencies and all that sort of thing. From just a planning perspective, when you look at these plans that Romero has put forth, do you think that this could work?
I think he might need to make some tweaks. The things that our readers brought up about some of the ways that he's planned transportation networks and things like that, it would be hard to implement that. It seems that there might be realistically some tweaks that he might need to make as this project goes forward.
You mentioned that he sees this as a potential reality, not just a theory or a concept. But I'm wondering, as a concept, if just the fact that he put forward these plans, if that makes some kind of statement, especially given all the discussion about border walls and trade with Mexico and immigration that's come up over the past several months.
Oh, absolutely. I think, and he said this several times, he thinks borders are obsolete. And that's not something that's just one person saying that. It's not just Romero who says that. There is a big camp of people who do seem to think that that is true and that is the world that we are headed towards. One of the big proponents of that idea is Parag Khanna, who's written a book that he recently released called Connectography. And in that book, he argues that it's cities, not nation states, that are going to be the political leaders in the future. So that idea is not new. But yeah, I think also in this specific context, it is very much a political statement. If you look at in the U.S., whether you want to build walls or you want to build bridges, you know, metaphorically speaking, this is definitely squarely in one camp in that way.
How unique or not unique is it to be proposing a whole new city where basically right now there's not much going on? We're not talking about building, you know, a small town into a city. We're talking about an area where really there isn't a whole lot and building a brand new city right there.
Yeah, you know, it's not that common. Cities sort of happen organically and then, you know, you have to go in and see how, what direction that growth should take place. And often those are the cities that function really well. So like going in and creating a whole new city often doesn't, or components of a city, you know, it's tough. I don't know of any recent examples of where that has worked. But yeah, it's tough. It's hard to just go in and design something and ask people to come there. You can't just go in and build something without really understanding how people would live there and whether people would live there and what kind of people would live there. That said, this is an interesting idea, and there's definitely a lot of activity across the U.S.-Mexico border, and it is pretty near Juarez and El Paso, which are pretty bustling cities. So, you know, I don't know. It might work.
Tanvi Misra is a staff writer for City Lab. We are talking about Mexican architect Fernando Romero's idea for a city straddling the U.S.-Mexico border. Tanvi, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
To celebrate the National Park Service's centennial, the American Academy of Poets commissioned 50 poems, one about a national park in each poet's state. In Arizona, the job fell to the state's poet laureate Alberto Rios, who wrote about Petrified Forest National Park. Rios joins me to talk about his poem and the process of writing it. And Alberto, why did you choose to write about Petrified Forest?
Isn't that the $64,000 question? I was given the choice when this was first presented to me, which was not very long ago, of Grand Canyon or Petrified Forest. So, of course, I think I'm going to write about the Grand Canyon. Who wouldn't?
And we are the Grand Canyon State, after
all.
We
are the Grand Canyon State, yeah, after all. And then it occurred to me, not only who wouldn't, who hasn't? Just like painters, everybody has painted the Grand Canyon. I don't know that I've ever seen a painting of the Petrified Forest. Similarly, I'm not sure I've read much work regarding the Petrified Forest. That's the site that needed celebration. Grand Canyon can take care of itself. It's a big boy.
Have you been there before? I mean, did you have to go there to travel
for this? I didn't have to go there.
I've
been there. I was there as a child and have visited it several times. And, you know, one of the curious things as a child, you're thinking about language, you're learning the world, and that word petrified has a lot of meanings. And we know scientifically that, you know, what it means, but to a child, you have this lingering, what was it so scared of, you know? And so it's always stayed with me as a linguistic pun as well.
So when you were putting this together in your head and thinking about how you're going to write a poem about the Petrified Forest, mm-hmm, what thoughts came to your mind? How did you decide what you were going to write
about?
Well,
that's it exactly. When you're presented with anything like this, how do you even know where to begin? And that's the great act of mystery in writing a poem to me. I don't know how I begin. Something just hits me. The moment somebody says something and I'm taking it seriously, it's like the first line springs up, even if I can't explain it.
Would you mind reading part of your poem for us?
Yes, I'm happy to do it. This is called Faithful Forest. I will wait, said Wood, and it did. 10 years, 100, 1,000, 1,000,000, it did not matter. Time was not its measure, not its keeper, nor its master. Wood was trees in those first days, and when wood sang, it was leaves, which took flight and became birds.
So you mentioned that sort of that first line springs to you, and the "I will wait" said wood, and it did. Obviously, this is very, very old wood. A lot of the imagery in the poem, though, sort of seems to come across as trees, which I think if you go to a forest, you think of as having trees. But the petrified forest, most of the trees, if not all of them, are on the ground.
That's what I like. What I like about this in so many ways is it called me into the realm of myth. It is something that to see a forest there, you have to look back a bajillion years, however many it is. And it's, so that place is an act of the imagination. That's a difficult thing to explain to a child. When I first went there, what a dud it seemed like, man. Like, this, what is this? Like a ripoff, you know, national forest, no, national park. But the more I thought about it and in subsequent visits and the more I read about it, the more alive it became. And it, in that sense, it was mythic. To understand it, you had to traverse many, many lifetimes, including its own.
Was that also part of the allure to you for writing about this, that you had to use your imagination to really kind of see what was there?
Absolutely. And I think that was a good way to help celebrate something that it might be difficult on first glance to know how to react to. So I think this was a perfect mix.
Arizona is so well known and closely tied with its national parks and national monuments, national forests, things like that. Did that give you any added sort of sense of pressure to come up with something good here?
Oh, yeah, of course it did. And luckily, it's gotten some attention just in that regard. This is a state largely comprised of federal land. So there was a lot of pressure in a good way. I mean, this is a state that gets talked a lot about in the media. This was another way to talk about it, and I think a very good and substantive way to talk about it. This was a challenging and exciting thing to be part of. It is a good effort. That is to say, we're trying to understand ourselves as a country. Right now in this election cycle and all of these different, you know, ways that we're all kind of fighting and speaking out, I think this is a good way to say this too. This too.
Alberto Rios is Arizona's poet laureate. His poem, Faithful Forest, about the Petrified Forest National Park, is part of a 50-state effort about a poem about one national park in each state. Alberto, thanks as always.
A pleasure.
The word for theater famously comes from a Greek one, meaning seeing place. But there are many people who believe your enjoyment of live comedies, dramas, and musicals should not be dependent on your ability to actually see them. KJZZ's Stina Sieg reports on how some Valley theaters are becoming more accessible to the visually impaired.
The show hasn't started yet at Phoenix Theater, but David Strife's job has. Sitting on a platform overlooking the stage, he leans into a microphone and says what he sees.
There's a two-story brick building, a business sign above a roll-top storefront door that reads Rosario's Car and Limo Service on the first floor there.
Strife's words are going straight into the headphones of a visually impaired theatergoer down below. When the play starts, Strife will keep going, speaking in between the dialogue, describing important actions, facial expressions, even costumes. Whatever it takes to help that patron completely picture tonight's musical. It's In the Heights by Lin-Manuel Miranda, you know, of Hamilton fame. And this process is called audio description. For the visually impaired,
it's huge. It's absolutely huge.
Marlo Kohler knows that now, but when she first lost her sight a decade ago, she had no idea what audio description was. Then she heard a demo, not during a play, but a movie.
Ghost.
And I'm going to bet you know the scene. Patrick Swayze, Demi Moore, a pottery wheel.
And he goes behind her sensually, and the describer was so good. I would have never known what was happening in that scene.
A little while later, Kohler heard live musical theater audio described for the first time. The show was Phantom of the Opera, and longtime audio describer Sue Berliner was the one speaking into Kohler's headphones.
I cried. I said, Sue, I had no idea how much I was missing until you described the musicals for me.
That's when Kohler, who's a social worker, took up spreading audio description as one of her causes.
Sometimes I'm a little pain in the tush because I'm relentless.
But that's what it takes. Pressure from people like Kohler got most local movie theaters to offer audio description. However, when it comes to live theater in the Valley, there's only one group that trains audio describers, Arizona Artability, and there's only a handful of theaters that offer regularly scheduled audio described shows. A few others will offer it on demand, but many other theaters don't even know the service exists.
If they don't know about it, they can't do anything about it.
Tom Belshon lost his sight 40 years ago, but that doesn't stop him from going to about 25 plays a year. In a perfect world, all of those would be audio described, but Belshon knows right now that it's just not realistic. Problem is, it's not just theaters that don't know about audio description. It's many visually impaired people, too.
There aren't enough of us that go.
Which means there's not enough demand to make audio description universal. That's why Sue Berliner, who's been an audio describer for nearly 20 years, says whenever she meets a visually impaired person, she tells them about the service, which is free, by the way.
I want to be supportive, and I want to be supportive of access in every sense of the imagination.
That also means supporting newer audio describers, like David Strife.
Other dancers enter from the back and sides, multicolor lights again.
Back at Phoenix Theater, the show is hurtling toward the end of Act One. The actors are dancing across the stage. To their left, two women are frenetically signing for deaf patrons. And up above it all, there's Strife, describing a tender moment between the musical's two romantic leads.
Standing on opposite sides, they look at each other, run towards each other, meet, embrace, kiss. Lights out.
The scene is sweet and exhilarating and understood by everyone in the house. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
House lights up. End of Act One.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.